Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Scatter Chatter. I'm your boy, Just Ray.
Hey, this is Will 93, and hey, before we get started, man, we want to keep in touch with the audience. We want to connect with you guys, so if you got comments, questions, concerns, maybe even a show topic, you know what, leave those comments at the segment down below, and we'll definitely be reaching out to you. We definitely want to interact with all of our listeners, all of our followers. With that said,
right,
Just Ray, we got a special guest, bro. We got a special guest.
Before we move on to that, we got the Facebook fan page. So you guys can definitely hit us up on the fan page. There's a graphic on the page. We want you guys to hit us up, add us, engage with us, comment and engage, which is very important so we can have a good show topic and have a better show. The show's for you guys. More so than it is
follow.
For us.
Follow us.
Tell your auntie, tell your mom and them to follow. And with that being said, tonight's guest we have DJ Quest Coast.
Man.
Hey.
One and only.
What's going on, family? What's going on? How y'all doing this evening?
All right.
Blessed,
introduce
man.
Yourself, Quest. Tell them who you are, man. Tell them what's popping.
I am a DJ called Quest, like a tribe called Quest, you know, from Inglewood, California, DJ, producer, event producer, multi-passionate entrepreneur, and just, you know, lover of life, father, and all great things above, you know?
Man, I think he was being modest, right?
He's holding back. I think he's got something else he wants to share. I don't know what it is.
Man.
But it's something.
Man.
It's something.
Man. Like Bullwinkle pulling something out of the hat.
Watch right.
Nothing on my sleeve.
Yeah.
You know, humility is virtuous, you know. And
man.
It's just the truth, you know.
That part.
It's just,
and man, and but man, it's all of the hats that you wear, and how intricate they are. It would seem as though, when you rattle off all of the things that you have been doing, personally, professionally, it would sound as if you don't have time to rest, you don't have time to just kind of catch your breath. But when you think about it, they're all intricate. Like five fingers on a hand, and they come together and they make it all make sense. And that's a huge thing, bro. That's a huge thing. We were talking, you know, before the show started, and man, you have a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, man. I've been really blessed and fortunate over the years. I was just focused from a very young age, man, and it was always something that kind of stood out to me. Some of my mentors told me early about never taking things for granted, and as I got older, I realized that I went through certain moments. I went through certain trials and tribulations and thunderdomes as a test, as a mental, like a you know, you have muscle memory. You know,
yeah,
it was just like, put this on the tool belt, include this into the psyche, into the realm of your intellectual intelligence, and it'll come back. And lo and behold,
right.
Every time, it all made sense later. It was like, oh, I went through this so I could be ready for this moment. You know, and so I remember that, and that it always stays in the front of my mind whenever I'm dealing with things. It's like, don't be worried. The character is built along the quest, not destination.
Man, I overstand you on that. So, we announced it, you know, DJ Quest, you know, Quest Coast, name of the company. But with all the hats, am I using your government name now? Or, I mean, are you that high up? I heard, you know, you're doing a whole bunch of stuff, man. Can we still be intimate and I can call you Quest, man?
You can call me Quest, brother. You can absolutely call me Quest. There was a time I wasn't gonna let anybody call me by my government, but you're right. In certain instances, I will definitely be summoned by my government with
right.
joy and grace. You know.
Right. Okay. I'm like, because you know, next thing you know, you're gonna be visiting the president, and well, maybe hopefully a new president. But anyway, you know what I'm saying. And,
I'm
you know, like Eazy-E and stuff.
45.
Right, right. Yeah, 45. Yeah, it might be kind of technical, but I'm gonna stay with Quest because I love him, and that's how we were introduced. And man, you got a lot of layers going on, bro. I know we got. I think on the list, and we had event coordinator. You even went into holistic health. Man, you done helped develop some children's books. You got kids and stuff growing up, you know. And now, I mean, and then we were introduced as, you know, as in a DJ family through Impact Record Pool. My man Tracy and Foot, rest in peace, Foot.
Yeah.
But man, now you got community activists going on, man. But before we jump into all that other stuff, man, let's talk about the first hat. You being the DJ, what got you into that field initially, man?
Well, I was inspired by a couple DJs early on. I used to go to these Rogers Park dances in the neighborhood. A park in my neighborhood that would have these monthly dances, and there was a DJ there and an MC, and I was already writing raps at the time, and I was just inspired, and so I begged my parents for some turntables, and in '95 they gifted me some turntables for Christmas, and just being really into music as an MC. I quite naturally grew to being a DJ. It was some pivotal moments that happened in 95, 96.
Guys, before you continue,
made me
before you continue, can somebody like either like turn off their sound or mute something or something? Because there's a lot of like crashing, a lot of like interference in between.
Oh, okay.
Does somebody have like a
computer?
I got something
going on.
I'm hearing less feedback. Okay, continue. I'm sorry.
All right.
Yes. So, is it better now? Is it good?
Yeah, it's better. It's a lot better.
So, I got these turntables in 95 for Christmas, but there were some pivotal things that happened to me that kind of shell-shocked me as an MC, a young, aspiring MC. You know, we lost our beloved brothers Tupac and Biggie. And so, those events in 96 and 97 really deterred me from wanting to rap a little bit, just to be honest with you. But I was still in love with music, and so I just gravitated to DJing. And from there, man, I think it was just being at the Rogers Park dances and the interaction between the DJ and MC and the crowd. That exchange, I became addicted to, and it became like, you know, one of my my drugs that I kind of experienced throughout my entire DJ career. That exchange is like no other, man. It just always stayed with me, you know.
Right. Well, let's give a little bit of emphasis and context. Rogers Park. For those who are listening and those who don't live in Los Angeles, Rogers Park is like one of the popular parks in Inglewood. I had to say it like that. Inglewood, California.
You got to say it like
that. Yeah, man. And it was one of the parks that gravitated to me. I was an L.A. kid, and I used to catch the La Brea bus down to Rogers Park to hoop. This was a time when some people may not even know Harold Miner or Paul Pierce, maybe a little bit more well-known. But we used to ball in the gym, and, man, if you didn't know anyone or if you couldn't hoop, you couldn't get down. But outside of the gym, the rest of the park was very, very inviting for these dances that Quest is talking about. It kept us out of trouble. It kept you focused on, you know, the things at hand. And that was one of the awesome things about this particular park. When you talk about community, community gravitated to this park. And for someone like me, who's in the roller skating community as well, some of my old school rollers are over at Rogers Park, and they're skating. They're skating like on Sundays and Saturdays out on the out of courts and stuff like that. So I had to put emphasis on that because I think this community was I know it was a trigger point for me. And Quest spoke on it, so I just had to put emphasis. So all my people over there at Rogers Park, hey, what's up?
Yeah, man, I just want to add, the staff there became like family because I was just like a kid. I never went to Boys and Girls Club there, but I was there every single day after school. And, you know, the staff there became like, you know, mentors and just family. You know, rest in peace, Dobie. We just lost him this year, and
that crew helped
help groom me, man. I mean, basketball coaching and baseball and just a little bit of everything there, man. And so it's a lot of memories at the park, growing from boy to man, you know what I'm saying?
That part.
So that's always family. Yeah.
Huge, man. Huge. Well, man, I'm just kind of torn with Dobie going, man. So,
yeah, man, that was tough.
That's a hard one. So let's move on though. Let's track through the evolution of Quest. So, I mentioned in that you are a DJ, but I didn't know you were MC. So this is something that I just learned. Fresh and firsthand, so this is dope stuff. But as a DJ, you needed to have events in some cases, and in some cases you created those actual events. So we're going to move away from the DJ hat a little bit. And how'd you get into event coordinating?
Well, I think it was a natural progression for me because I've always aspired to be like the best in the field of DJing, just the best that I can be, not like from a competitive tip, just being the best that I can be and how I can be at the top of the food chain as a leader for the for the culture and the community in which I come from. And so, you know, being that I was an entrepreneur by mind, just my mom was an accountant, my dad was a contractor, so it just always taught me to, like, do for self. So I started my own business early. I started a record label and a studio and then went through the mixtape phase and left that phase. And as the internet opened up, I started a internet marketing company and like a vlog and, you know, just had some interesting business dealings there. And after that phase, I was a little ahead of the curve, like 2005, 2006. Anybody talking about internet radio and vlogging, it was like, you were speaking a new language that hadn't really touched the community yet. And so I was too far ahead of the curve, and then we went into a recession. But we came out of that recession, and I started touring as tour management now, production management.
Mm-hmm.
So along that, I always aspired because I started to see certain festivals sprouting up around the world. And as I toured, I realized how infatuated I was about festivals and these large events. And so I did my first festival on Venice Beach in 2011 called Wreck-a-Palooza. It is a community event.
Yeah.
It was where
yeah.
we activated all of the recreation that was there in the center of Venice Beach. So from basketball
right.
to handball to skating to rollerblading. And
mm-hmm.
then we added like a kids area, activated the kids area. Then we activated the stage. And we had just lost the legendary Tina Marie, who was from Venice, California. And so
right.
I was charged to do a Tina Marie tribute. And I had members of Fishbone put together a band for me. And we had
mm-hmm.
Charlie Tuna from Jurassic 5 and,
right.
and just a bunch of locals after that. And that was like the start of my festival career. And we got it all for less than $20,000. The city of L.A. gave me a commemoration. It was the late Councilman Bill Rosenthal who awarded us that accommodation. And so I was like, man, we on to something. And I always looked at my company as a production company, not just like a DJ company. And so I always said we, us, you know, not I
mm-hmm.
or me when I talk
right.
to my clients. But always just projecting that this was bigger than me and that I could hire other people and I can offer other people opportunities and I didn't have to just forward all the opportunities myself, because I always looked at it was an analogy like, do I want to be the barber or do I want to own the barber shop? You know, and I'd rather own the barber shop and put 10 great barbers in there than be the one great barber. And when I leave, my money stops too. So that was my idea in DJing. Have a production company. So I would rent equipment for myself and charge my client, you know, and just how that kind of grew into a bigger production company as I learned logistics and I learned the technical side. I got into sound engineering and so that was like a thing of how can I put it? Just a natural progression. So then I started doing you know, other events. You know, Will, I've been doing events my whole life, bro. Like, I did some of my first events, like, when we first met each other way back in the day in Inglewood,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
I was throwing parties with my friends on the block, and we was just having parties in the house, you know, and I was DJing those events as a teenager. And so all of that grew into me wanting to, like, plan larger events, and then I kind of landed the West Adams Block Party about 4 years ago. Almost 4 years
mm-hmm.
ago now, in which we created a block party in the city of Los Angeles that was like, they told us we couldn't do it. They told us you can't do hip hop on Adams Boulevard in the neighborhood. You can't do it. That's never gonna work. That's not safe. And the first year we did it, it was not just safe. We had 3,000 people show up. We had Dougie Fresh and Talib Kweli show up, and Dom Kennedy showed up, and a host of Bushwick Bill showed up, and we did a Dilla Donut pop up, and it was
right.
really, really phenomenal. It was like the borderline of a community event and a paid festival. We were like, this could be a paid festival. I would pay to be here. But I had, I was able to successfully get the city of Los Angeles to sponsor the event. And they
mm-hmm.
came in with like $30,000 worth of sponsorship money. So that took the production level up a notch. We must have spent like $80,000 that year. The second year we came back and we did it again, and it was super dope. The second year we came back, we had Master Ace, Farside.
Yeah.
I'm drawing a blank. We had a bunch of cats, though, and then the next year we came back, we had KRS-One and Beanie Man, and these are just the headliners, because we grew it to from a hip-hop festival to a hip-hop, Latin, and Caribbean music festival right in the heart of Los Angeles. And it's one of the only ones on that level. The first year we did 3,000 people. Second year we did 5. The next year we did 10,000 people. That was last year. We went from
last
one
year.
Stage to six stages, you know, in a matter of 3 years. And we can't do it this year, of course, because of COVID. But in the midst of that, I picked up the Mid-City Art and Music Festival and started curating and producing that. Also in Mid-City. And then I picked up the Obama Fest and co-curated that event along with Bridge Street Productions and my man Martin Ludlow. And shout out to Kamani Black for he be throwing me live. That's my brother. Then I landed a contract with the city of Inglewood this year and produced the stage for the MLK Festival, in which KGLH had a stage and my company Elevate Culture Present and my business partner Thurs, who's also an artist and producer and songwriter. He has a company called Party in My Living Room. We produced that stage and we brought out D-Smoke and Tiffany Goucher and Iman Omari and Nonchalant Savant and DJ Artistic and Battle Cat. And, I even started a group with Battle Cat called the G-Funk All-Stars for a moment, in which it was just an all-star collective. It really was an event that turned into, like, let's make an album. And that project, I mean, it was so many superstars on that project, it was hard to harness that, I ain't gonna lie, because everybody in the group was a solo artist and a star, you know, and that was just,
alone,
it was heavy.
Yeah.
But we had some real, like, it was like Grammy nominated, Grammy Award winning, like, all-star collective, and it created a ripple effect where people, they didn't just want to come to our events anymore. They started booking us to perform at other shows, and it was like, we a group that they booking to perform, and we ain't got no song. It's just phenomenal musicians who individually people love, and to get anybody to sit in, like our first show in the crowd, we had like Anderson .Paak and James Fauntleroy and like, you know, just like, just Rance Dobson for 1500, like just people just showing up who are like way up there just because they were just excited. Like Erykah Badu tweeted about it and Currency tweeted about it, and people was just like, whoa, this is really, really dope. We love what you guys are doing. Keep it up. And now Battle Cat is reignited, and he's dropping new music. Now he's inspired to record. He has a whole album he's about to drop with him as an MC now and producing, and got records with all kind of new cats. And he's always been active, but these projects really help really push him to a new place in his career and being able to drop this music. So it's been so much,
man, that, now it's just like I have a production company, you know, most recently the Juneteenth celebration in Leimert Park, in the middle of COVID, in the middle of a civil unrest, we were able to assemble 7,000 black men and women and allies. It was some Latinos out there, with some white folks out there. Everybody showed up. It was safe. I can't say we social distance properly because it was packed like sardines, but a lot of people had masks on, and we were there with, you know, the city got behind us, LAPD supported us, Wall State supported us, and we had an amazing production team, Il Camille and my lady DJ Freckles and CIA person Lynn, who's a great attorney, criminal defense attorney, who calls himself the abolitionist Lincoln lawyer. And Tony from Hot and Cool Cafe and my boy Fred, DJ FM. We all just kind of got in the trenches and mapped out this event in a matter of like 10 days. We had 40 artists, 3 stages, and over 7,000 people show up. And it was just phenomenal, man. We didn't have no permit. It was a rally. It was really a rally for black excellence in the city and all of the powers that be. Just all came in support and made sure that it was just a beautiful day in the neighborhood, man. And when people ask how did that happen, all I can say is it was bigger than all of us. I believe the ancestors was a part of that. I believe Almighty God put his touch on that. And we were just, you know, channeling all of that energy into the community, and it was really, really felt in a real way. It was like a big group hug. We needed that in the community, you know, to kind of reignite our mind, our body, and our spirit to know that the work, a lot of the work that we have to do right now in this time and space is the inner work. It's the work that you have to do on the inside of yourself to make sure that you're ready to radiate good energy back into the world and be a productive, you know, human being in this place, you know?
That part, man. We need that. That's huge. That's extremely huge. I'm straight loving the response to the question, man, because I'm just glad that someone is picking up the mantle and they're pushing the baton a little bit. So that's huge. Extremely huge.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, that's a lot of work. So, Quest. So with that being said, like, do you have any like classic inspirations as DJs that we wouldn't know of? Like, who inspired you to like? I mean, like, do you, like outside of who you like mentioned?
Yeah, for sure. You know, the first DJ that I saw like with my eyes was Michael Flip Barber. Michael Flip Barber is a DJ and a producer. He had records. He used to be down with the LA Zoo, and he did a lot of work with Razzcast back in the day.
Okay.
And so Michael Flip Barber, his brother is Brian Barber. He's the video director who done so many projects with Outkast, and he directed the movie Idlewild. Those are some Inglewood babies right there. And we grew up on the same block. They were older than me, but Mike would come bring his turntables and put them in my living room. And although my brother and some of my cousins were gangbanging, the gangsters would come inside my house, flamed up, and be breakdancing. You know what I'm saying? And so I was like, whoa, this is deep. And I was really young at
right.
the time, you know? And then I started going to the Rogers Park dances. So that's my brother DJ Space and MC Big Al.
Right.
And then, after that, there was a brother named Kenny D. He used to be on KGFJ back in the day, way before my time. But Kenny D was a local DJ in Inglewood. He was at the Mirage. He was at Dynasty. He was at Market Street Bar and Grill, the VFW, like a local Chitlin circuit in Inglewood, right? But Kenny D introduced me to Danny Foot James and Tracy Kendrick. And Impact Record Pool when I was in high school, and that literally changed the trajectory of my career, like, immensely, you know. And from there, I began DJing at the Market Street Bar and Grill as a young, tender 17-year-old and, like, a 25 and up high preferred crowd. I'm playing old school from, like, 6 to 10 every day, and then from 10 to, not every day, but every Friday, and then from 10 to 2, I'm playing hip-hop and R&B. And that just laced my shoes in so many ways. It was DJs like Groovy Lou, rest in peace. It was DJs like Alcatraz, who were there with me, DJ Divine and Cornbread and MC Big Al. All of those guys were there and kind of like really looked out for me. 7 Oasis, Greg, and it was a few DJs down with 7 Oasis. I was hella inspired by those guys because they were throwing parties. And I just wanted to, like, get down with them. You know, DJ Dents was a part of that crew. And it was just a few other DJs that was down with them, you know. I used to go to the Soda Pop. The Soda Pop, it was a DJ there named DJ Scratch. Not like East Coast DJ Scratch, but he was in there. And he was dope, too. DJ Keelu Grand from Freestyle Fellowship and Macy Gray's DJ. That's my
Freestyle
brother, man.
No snap.
Yeah, man. He laced my shoes in so many ways, too. He was like OG Big Bro, and he just was like, what, you don't know about this song? You don't know about this record? Oh, I got a record. I got a story for you and why this is. And, you know, so, man, I learned so much music. You know what I'm saying? And then it transitioned into DJ Battle Cat. Like, he saw me DJing at Maverick Flat one day.
Uh-huh.
And he tells the story, and he was like, yo, I was just amazed by the kid's song selection and how he played the music. And I was like, I just gave him his props. Like, yo,
I'm sitting there with my wife trying to eat, but I'm like, damn, who is DJing? He's killing it. He, you know, and so that created and sparked a friendship with us. And over the years, it blew my mind. I would get like random calls from Battle Cat, like, hey, yo, I need you to do this. And I'd be like, how do you have my number, bro? Like, and why me? Like, how the fuck? You know, excuse, I don't know if I'm concussed, but I'm like, man, how? But okay, I ain't gonna question. I pull up, you know. And like one time he called and asked me just for music. Man, I need some music. I just need some music. I know you got the records. I just pull up to the studio, bro. And I'm like, really? You want my library? I want your library, like.
Right.
And
right. Of all people.
Of all people, and we just started sharing music and just became really, really good friends over the years. And, man, he took me around Dre. He took me around Snoop. He took me around everybody that loved him. He took me around them and was like, yo, this is my young gun, you know, but not just like my young protege. Like, he the truth right now. So, I, you know, whatever you paying me, you owe him that same amount.
Wow.
I was like, wow. That's love right there. So, you know, he could have just broke the deal and broke me off 500 here and pocketed the other two or three. But nah, he made sure that I was getting the same amount of money that he was getting. And he also went as far as to say, you need to make your name bigger on the flyer. Your name is not big enough on the flyer. Your name don't need to be small. Your name needs to be just as big as my name on the flyer. And I was like, damn, I mean, I'm not, like, nah. He was like, and he made sure when we would do events together that anybody that was doing those type of flyers for us, they did it in a certain way. And just that love is priceless, bro. I mean, so there's also, like, DJs, like, artistic. DJ Mal Ski, you know. The East Coast classic DJs that you know about, you know, the Jam Master J's and the Hurt, you know, the Flashes, the Red Alerts. I really, 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 really love my brother Dougie Fresh. Like, we've worked together on the festivals. He's called me to do other events with him. But just the way that he MCs, that has inspired me because I MC, like, not just like rap, but like I host. And so being able to keep the party going and tie it all together through music and song and real crowd participation, I learned so much from Dougie Fresh, man. And I mean, the list goes on. It's a bunch of like Uncle Jam's Army and Roger Clayton and a lot of those type of cats. Joe Cooley, the Egyptian Lover, of course, the Beat Junkies, you know.
Right.
And
local.
Exactly, man. I mean, it's a lot of DJs I get game from, like, just listening to their crates, like, as of late through Instagram, like a Ninth Wonder or a DJ Scratch, a Just Blaze, even a D-Nice. These DJs have the freedom, and I've always DJed like this, but we don't always have platforms where we have the freedom to just play and dig in the crates
right.
And not play the most obvious stuff. So that's one thing that I love about the quarantine is that. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to ask you two off questions. Have you ever DJed at the Grand Star Jazz Cafe in downtown L.A.? Did you ever get down over there?
No, I have not. I have not. But I have heard of some of the sets. I know, like, Slowpoke and a bunch of like, real, real turntablists be over there doing events. There's one event that Battle Cat goes over there and does with those cats. But just different promoters that I know about the club, but I haven't had a personal chance to DJ there, though.
Yeah, because I know, like, a lot of the Beat Junkies and Babu and Mr. Chalk, they been there often. They have an event. And then another question I was going to ask, like, side question. Like, you mentioned a lot of, like, DJs and producers. Have you ever done anything with Madlib or Flying Lotus?
Not Flying Lotus, but not even Madlib. I mean, I've done some stuff with Jay Dilla's little brother.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that Madlib? That's Madlib, right? No,
I don't think that's Madlib.
No, Illa J. No, it's not. I'm getting them twisted. That's Illa J. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I haven't worked with Madlib. Definitely a fan of his work though, as well as Flying Lotus, man.
Haven't
got around to those guys. Yeah, man. I've been out the country. Like we've been on a similar festival, like with Flying Lotus.
Okay.
It's interesting. A lot of cats, like, I didn't meet Snoop for the first time in the United States. I met Snoop for the first time in Germany.
Yeah, that's usually how you meet. He's like, hey, don't I know you from the hood? Yeah, I know you. Yeah.
Yeah. Terrence Martin, too. Like, I didn't meet Terrence in the neighborhood. Like, I knew of him, but I met him, and we knew of each other, but we met, like, on the Rock the Bell tour. You know what I'm saying? Like, on the East Coast, though. You know, and that just happens that way though sometimes.
Let me just say this, y'all. West Coast just stands out. Quest said he's seen Snoop in Germany, but yeah, we just stand out. Just West Coast got this kind of swag, it's kind of movement, it's kind of groove that we just kind of connect. We could be across the room from one another because when I saw the list of the DJs that Quest has been around and has been inspired by, there's a certain movement or a certain kind of energy that you know, okay, that is a DJ. This is a, you know, this is a person who has honed their craft. And we'll all meet up. Like, I've gone to a club. Because I started out my promotions in clubs and special events. And I'll go to a club and I'll just hang out by the DJ just to see what he or she is out there doing. And you look at the craft, you look at the art, you look at how, because it is a craft. I mean, you have to practice at this kind of thing. So when you mentioned several of these names and these influences, some that are of your age or younger, some are much older,
and let me,
I can see the inspiration.
Let me just interject real quick, bro.
Go ahead.
Quick, because you just pointed something out that you said him or her, you know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
Let me just be clear that there are some female DJs that have been instrumental in my career, like Silky D and DJ Spark.
Right.
Silky D, the queen, Silky D, she's been a real true supporter and friend for so long. And she's original Uncle Jam's Army crew.
Right.
And her daughter, DJ Spark. Her daughter, DJ Spark, was so boss. He was DJing for Omarion for many years. He was DJing for Immature.
Yep.
And what ended up happening is she got an opportunity to DJ for Layla Hathaway.
Sure did.
And and as she was doing more events with Layla Hathaway, Layla's schedule was becoming more busy than Omarion's schedule.
Right.
At the time. And there became to be some conflicts of interest on dates. And so, being the professional that she is, she was like, well, you know, Omarion's my friend, you know, my brother. Like, I can't leave him hanging. So who can I put him with that can carry the ball, for me? And she passed me the rock, and that turned into like a 2-year project for me and Omarion. And me and Omarion went to elementary school together and grew up together and have, like, a lot of unique history together. And so being able to tour the world with Omarion as his DJ was phenomenal because that was the first time that I was on tour internationally as the featured DJ. You know, prior to that, I was tour manager or production manager or sound engineer or stage manager.
Right.
Which was awesome experience because I was touring with, like, the really, really high royalty in music, Nas and Damian Marley and Morgan Heritage and Justin Bieber and Jasmine V and different people like that. But as the featured DJ,
That was phenomenal because Omarion is a superstar around the world. They love him. He's like a dance god, you know. And so I got to see how powerful TV is because when we were touring, he was on Love & Hip Hop. And so that reignited his celebrity. And now we're doing shows all over. You know? And he had a hit record with Mustard at the time. So we were really,
right.
We were really doing some cool things at that moment, you know. But DJ EQ, a female DJ, you know.
Yeah.
And then
that's my crew right
DJs
there.
Like yeah, you feel me? Then there's people like... I had a homegirl, DJ LA, back in the day. She was with an Impact Record Pool.
That's right.
But DJ Miss Jack Daisy and Tierra Monique and PZB and even my lady now, you know, DJ Freckles. My son's mom is a DJ. DJ Nyla, she's in New York right now.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's always been like phenomenal DJs around, whether they was male or female. GG Sweet, we've done a lot together, man.
Yeah.
I was super inspired by GG. When I started doing my special events, I would hire GG to just come through, you know, and that's how I built the relationship with her, you know. So, yeah, man, although this is a male-dominated industry, female DJs are definitely priceless and matter to. It's a lot of killer female DJs. I think their perspective on music, just playlisting, outside of all the technical stuff, just the way a female kind of picks records and her playlist style has always been something that I've always admired from a lot of female DJs. You know, it's too many to name, really.
Man. But you named him. You named him. You got him in,
man.
Bro.
It's true.
Man,
it's
man.
Many more. It's a lot of DJs that I did name, but, you know, for sake of time, you know, I just love the culture.
I love the culture, too. Again, I started out club promoting, and then I got into record promotions, which landed me the deal as the program, the promotions director at World on Wheels. When I got to World on Wheels and I started to get around more DJs, I started to gravitate towards that role. I used to have DJ meetings at the skating rink with some of our in-house DJs. And, one of my homeboys, he's like a brother to me, DJ Spin, said to me, how could you talk to us about DJing and you're not a DJ? And I was like, whoa. And I was like, ouch. So, but it made sense. And so I canceled all the meetings and I started to teach myself to DJ. I had a great ear for music. So it came down to blends, pitches, vibes, the kind of music energy that you needed, and honed in a craft and continue to do so to this very day. But my DJ hat, man, it's been, I think I got a pretty good DJ hat.
Well, you earned it, man. I remember just being in the record pool meetings with you, and you said your ear for music was good.
Right.
Your ear for music was really good, and it was unapologetically, like, honest. And so I think, like, if anybody knows, you were giving honest feedback before there ever was a DJ Head. And I love DJ Head. I'm going to just be honest, you know. You on that bullhorn, you would send artists home crying, or they would feel charged, or they would take the information and say, okay, I'm going to go be better. But they would come back, you know. And
what
if
a better
they
product.
Wasn't, yeah, they come back with a better product if they wasn't broken, you know? And I appreciate that about you. That became like a main attraction. If the bullhorn wasn't in the Impact Record Pool meeting, you know, I don't think people really understand how impactful Double Entendre, the record pool, was to the culture of L.A. and music, man. I saw some really, really, really big artists go from nothing to – I mean, come on, DJ Mustard was the DJ, and he brought YG up there first, and YG, and you might have
blew the horn on YG, you know, if I remember correctly, but at the end of the day,
I did.
it was all in love, and man, that was the beauty in what you did, and so like, it's tough because like anybody with an ear to be a DJ, anybody that loves music and understands the theory of music and how the songs can go together to be a DJ can start DJing, you know. Especially now, the difference back then and the difference now is the access to the music. You know, before, the DJs didn't have, if you wasn't a DJ or you wasn't a DJ that was tapped into a record pool or any type of relationships to get the records, you were buying physical copies to actually DJ. And you had to really love it because you're talking about thousands of dollars worth of music at that point, you know.
Right.
And so what made Kid Capri back in the day is that he had the records. What made some reggae DJs with the dub plate, that guy or that gal, was because they had exclusives. Now exclusives on the internet, so it ain't exclusive no more. Everybody got it. And so now.
And everyone thinks they're a DJ. Everyone thinks they're a DJ.
Yeah.
Terrible.
It's true because everybody can get equipment, you know, which I welcome. But just because you got equipment and you got music, that don't mean you can DJ. I can listen for 10 minutes how you transitioning records and if you are a DJ or a playlist, you know.
Right.
After 30 minutes, I'm like, okay, this is a good playlister. They know what to play, but they don't know how to play it. Or, wow, they don't know what to play, but they actually can DJ, you know. They got it, you know.
Right.
And when I say they got it,
yeah,
I'm talking about MC game. I'm talking about technique. I'm talking about musical knowledge. So it's very important, you know.
Yeah, especially for that hat, man. And music makes the world go round.
Yes.
Music makes the world go round as it goes around. So, man, just the DJs you just rattled off, man, it takes me down our memory lane, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah, man. Yeah, bro.
But we talk about transitions. You talked about transitions in the music and having an idea or gauge as to where their level of skill set is. So let's talk about that a little bit. When you started with your event coordinating, was it easy to engage in community activism? Was it easy to transition from your DJ hat and producer hat to this event coordinator and promoter hat to now this community activism hat?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you feel a tremendous responsibility when you realize the ramifications of pulling together more than 500 people in one public space at one time. That's a public address, and now you have a certain public safety responsibility.
And responsibility, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, in front of you. And so when I found out that Les Brown was a DJ, I was like, okay, I'm on to something. I'm not wasting my time by DJing. It's like I'm just building up my audience. So when I have something meaningful and impactful to share with the people, they're going to be all ears, you know. And so that's a beautiful thing. And as I was developing these community events, I had to be mindful of the people in the community. I had to actually think about how I could best represent what the community looks like in doing, like, the West Adams Block Party. You know, we have a black and brown community largely. I'm partnered with some white guys who own a pizza shop and a record label. And how do I best represent my community while working with
you know, major corporations in a sense. Like, these guys are very successful in music. You know, they got some money. They built out a very cool pizzeria. We have a lot of things in common. Even though they're white and I'm black, it was just like, okay, this was a great collaboration for us to do. It bought everybody social currency. At the same time, it was an opportunity for us to go into the community and spread a word. Now, what that word was going to be was ultimately going to be up to me as the MC, because the mic was in my hand. And so now, what are you going to say? Are you just going to not say nothing? Are you not going to address certain things? Could you not be political? Well, I'm not a nonprofit. I'm not a church. I'm an artist.
Right.
First, you know, so yeah, I can speak to certain issues. I can speak to positive. I can speak to mind, body. So I can speak to things that I think that we could start with to all cope with the many things that are happening around us. Because I think a lot of the things that we deal with all kind of turns into
a call to arms.
Yeah, it was a call to arm and a great opportunity for me to step my business profile up and transition to the next level, because now I have thousands of people in front of me. Let's make this meaningful. Let's make this impactful. Let's leave people with a sense of hope. Let's give them some instructions. Let's create call to action so people are not just leaving. Building up momentum, and then it dissipates after, you know. And so every event, I try to figure out what more call to action can we actually do and be consistent upon and whatnot. And so, yeah, it's been an easy transition to engage in community activism wholeheartedly. And as the time grows, like, I've always been that person at heart, though. So I do think that you have to still be that person inside, and that's why I go back to being centered in alignment with self, knowing thyself, mind, body, and spirit, and understanding the power that you hold within yourself, and being okay with that, being at one with that, and understanding the power that's there. Because a lot of the times, like, one of the books that I'm reading right now is called Power Versus Force. A lot of the times we try to force ourselves into certain positions or rooms or anything you want to force yourself into. And force will never last. You can try to force, but there's always going to be great resistance, and it's going to be a lower consciousness, and so it won't last. It's going to be bad energy there. And with power, though, you're consorting a higher level of consciousness. And power is almost allowing people to make the decision for themselves. You know, so when you empower others, you give them the opportunity to make the decisions for themselves. And so they think it becomes a little bit more meaningful to them, because now you lift them up, you elevate them as a person, as a player in the game. You know, but if you're forcing everything, most of the time it doesn't work. And so
that's right.
I was that person, so I was stepping into a powerful position, you know, because I was using my higher level of consciousness to put these events together, and it wasn't about me. Like, I could have created these stages and then, like, start dropping my music and just made it about me. It wasn't necessarily about that. I feel like when it's time for me to do and drop music or do something artistic, I'll do it, you know. But right now, it's important to get these events off and be the leader in the situation.
That's right.
I wore multiple hats, you know. And so I built a business wearing multiple hats in order to create other positions for other people to come in. And so now I got a crew, you know, and it just helps you know, move the ball. You got to, like, put in the work and kind of, like, show people what the work ethic should look like before you can expect people's work ethic to, like, match yours, you know. They have to see what your ethics are, you know. And so I put that down,
part.
And now it's people that's like, yo, I'll help you. Let me know what you need. I'll step up. And that's a call to action, too, you know.
Well, and that power piece that we're talking about, especially from that book, is that Dr. Hawkins? I think it's
I
have it in my my Audible. Good book, good read. I think a lot of things were kind of instilled with you, but from the book standpoint, it just kind of solidified your mind state, which sends us to the next set of the next question. Black Lives Matter. Okay, Black Lives Matter has come to the forefront a lot in the black consciousness. Do you think with the killing of George Floyd and the Black Lives movement and the energy that it brings, has it changed your view on black culture and perspectives? And has it changed the way you kind of monetize or leverage your event?
You know, I think for me personally and honestly speaking, man, I've been a pro black nationalist since I was 18.
Got it.
And it was always a challenge, you know, because that was something that it was almost dangerous to be, you know. It could be problematic, you know, because it wasn't always widely accepted, even by other black people. Not to mention other races and of people. I wholeheartedly believe that there's one human race, and that we all have different cultural upbringings, and that's what makes us uniquely different. Science, we can go into science and go down this trail of black and white and colors and all of that, but I believe there's one race of people, and when I say I'm pro-black, that doesn't mean I'm anti-anybody. That just means I love myself. I love my mother, my father, my children, you know, my family, and my community, you know what I'm saying? And I love nature, I love God, you know. And so has it changed my perspective? My perspective has always been very, very pro-black, you know. I studied Dr. Claude Anderson and Anthony Browder and Ajwa Quaid, Dr. Ben. The name, it just goes on and on and on. You know, I even had a moment where I thought I was going to join the Nation of Islam, where I didn't join, but I just made good friends, you know. So I've always been very, very black in my demonstration, and there's always been a challenge because being super, super black is like being on an island. You know, James Baldwin had a great quote about maybe being black was always like being in a constant sense of rage at all times. And I'm paraphrasing, but just to have that and understand what we have been through, what our ancestors have been through, all that energy is still like real, because if we believe in science has always taught us that energy is never created nor destroyed, it's merely transferred from one place to the next. And so where does all of this trauma go? It gets passed down generationally through habits and fears and traumas and ways of life that we have protected ourselves, or so we thought we were protecting ourselves, you know. So I grew up with parents who came out of the civil rights movement, were kids in the civil rights movement, rather, right? And to their young adult age into the still in the 70s, they were having kids and stuff. And so you think about that generation, they were either we not going that route, or we still all the way here. And a lot of people that stayed there did not have a financial freedom that they deserved or maybe were able to look for, because as the great economist Richard Wolff talks about how labor wages in the private sector and the labor market froze in 1970. And we're talking about still to this day. So for 50 years, the the prices of what we pay, wage, our labor force, has not grown with respect to inflation over the past 50 years. And so now you have people in 1970, if you had a post office job and you were a manager, you had a great job. You could buy a car, any car you wanted almost. You can buy a live a great quality of life. Well, 10 years later, that quality of life diminished. And then we're into the crap epidemic. And then 10 years later again, money is still flowing because we're coming out of the crack epidemic. But jobs are starting to, like, the pay is starting to change. And then you go into 2000, now we're in a recession in the 2000s and so on and so forth. And so it took these years for all of this to happen. And so I've always had a perspective that we needed economic freedom. We needed equity.
Yeah.
I've always thought that. I've always thought, like, I just need the money so I can get the raw materials and I can understand manufacturing. I just need the resources so I can go into manufacturing and import and international imports and exports. When I was younger, I wanted to be an international businessman because I wanted to do imports and exports. I was like, wait, we could go here and get a natural resource, polish it up, do what we do with it, send it through the ringer, manufacture it, out comes a product, and now I have a product. I want to do that.
Right.
You know, but there was really no pipeline to show me how to go into manufacturing. There was no, here, we're going to show you how to be a manufacturer. Maybe you can go work for the plant. But nobody who worked for General Motors or anything in Motown started a car company and started manufacturing a car. That wasn't part of the trajectory. You know, that was just like, no, we need to keep them as employees. And so we could talk about equality all we want, but until we are, you know, have equal rights to the resources and economics of this capitalistic society, which, you know, it's open market, anybody can go get it right now, it's true. But until we're equal economically, there cannot be no equality because there will always be somebody hanging their hat over us. You think about systematic oppression right now. An all-black-owned business has to still do business with a white company in order to be a black-owned business. They have to subscribe to some type of white payment system, a POS system.
Right.
There are now there are black-owned systems that are coming to light. They buy their office supplies from Office Depot and Staples, which are white-owned companies. They have to purchase office gear, tables, chairs, I mean, lights, switches, the construction supplies to build their office. All of that stuff is our white-owned companies. And so that's where you see systematic oppression, to where even if you want to start a black-owned business and you say, I'm going to be a 100% black-owned business, I'm going to spend my money and do my thing, you still have to go spend money with white companies in order to get your business to place for market. And so that perspective has always been there. Now, how do we affect the way that we monetize and leverage our events within all of that? We still try to shop black. When I did the Juneteenth event, 99% black-owned. It was 100%, excuse me, 100% black-owned vendors. We had black-owned sound companies, staging companies, which is pretty powerful. All of our vendors are black-owned. We didn't accept no sponsorship dollars outside. But this is not like we're not trying to do business with white people or we didn't want to collaborate, because we did have a lot of companies reach out to us, like, how can we be involved? How can we be involved? This one wasn't about that. This one was about showing the solidarity and the black excellence that can come together in a matter of moments just to celebrate us. And so we reached out laterally. Like, we just reached out, like, an arm's length, everybody in the crew, and we came up with black streaming companies and black photographers and videographers and artists and you name it. Everybody there was part of the culture, and that was a beautiful thing. You have to say, like you said, we're not working with the white companies, because I believe collaborations can be good. You know, if you're a 51% owner in a company, that's still a black-owned business. You know, what Tyler Perry did with Lionsgate or something like that, like, we could talk about it, but he won at the end of the day, you know. You can talk about all the politics or whatever you like or dislike about it. He took his collaboration and bought his own later, and now he controls his narrative. Whether you agree or not, that's not neither here nor there. You know, with the Wayans brothers, that family, you know. You know, collaboration can be good, you know. It's just how you leverage it and how you see things and what you know to be true and how you're able to navigate in that, you know. Being taken advantage of is not collaboration, though. Somebody just giving you a bad deal just to be in bed or get some clout. I don't promote that.
Right.
But,
right.
I can't say it changed me. Maybe evolved
uh-huh.
me and made me listen more. Made me think
good.
About other black perspectives because we're not a monolith. And so I was a Pan-Africanist or whatnot, and now I'm just unapologetically pro-black, and I listen to all sides of the black agenda, and I listen to what we have in common. I don't listen to what we don't have in common. I try to, like, keep that away because we don't have time to think about all the things that we don't agree on. We have to focus on the things that we do agree on right now so we can pick up the ball, keep the ball in play, and score and keep scoring. You know what I'm saying? And play great defense and just stay on the tail of oppression and white supremacy, you know, and just be mindful of and intentional and purpose-driven about how powerful we are as a people, and that we all, I'm talking when I say all, white, black, Asian, Indian, you name it, right, Latino, are all pulling from the infinite space of intelligence. And so if you don't operate or move on an idea that you pull from out of the infinite space of intelligence, that somebody else has the opportunity to operate on that too, you know. And
true.
Humans have this IP law and these patent laws or whatnot, but before you get there, everything is an idea, and we all are pulling from the same idea pool. It's who
this
operates on it, and you know.
So then let me ask this then. With that information and that energy and that perspective, what made you form Elevate Culture? Or what? Or am I saying that you formed that, or did you partner and become Elevate Culture? What got you there?
Well, yeah. I oftentimes when you name something after you, Quest Coast Productions is my DJ name, but it's also my company name. Quest Coast Productions
right.
is not my DJ name; just DJ Quest Coast. But oftentimes, unless you have made exuberant amounts of money or some extreme success, it could be your name. You have to keep introducing yourself. You have to keep adding value to your name because other people are like, oh, well, he's just, that's ego. One can think of it as ego just by naming your company after your name, but I don't agree with that because some of the biggest companies on the planet are all family-owned businesses, you know. And so with them being family-owned businesses, I realized that it was very impactful to put your name as your legacy because your company could be your legacy, right? A part of your legacy, rather. But I also wanted to take it a step further and power and how you can just brand something and
mm-hmm.
And that brand could now be bigger than you and it's not about you anymore, you know. And so Elevate Culture to me is a complete sentence. We want to simply
mm-hmm.
elevate the culture and all cultures. You know what I'm saying? Oh, I'm a lover of culture. I like, you know, Asian food. And I like Indian food. And, you know, I like other types and styles of music. And so all that being said, we wanted to rebrand the company and be intentional with how we edutain.
Mm-hmm.
and elevate artivism, where there's a collaboration of education and entertainment and artistic expression and activism.
Wow. Okay. Okay. That's good. That's good stuff right there. Well,
thank you, brother.
And the reason why I asked about that is when we talked about black perspectives in the black consciousness and being pro-black, and I shared this with Ray a little while back. My great-grandmother was a survivor of Black Wall Street Massacre.
Wow.
At 5 years old, she left. She and my great-great-grandparents had left Tulsa, migrated to Nashville, and set up shop here. And so having her grow into being an educator and then trying to instill that culture in me young, I remember sitting watching like cartoons, and then cartoons would go off, and then she would teach me the kind of history that's not necessarily in the history books. And this is all pre-internet. We didn't have Google then. You know what I'm saying? You had power when you had encyclopedias in your home to make that world come a little bit closer. So as I hear the passion and as I hear your responses to the questions that we put together, then we ask about, okay, this is Quest past, and this is where he is now with Elevate Culture. What are your future plans for that? What do you see you want to, how do you wish to pass the baton on to your kids? Take your time. I know there's a lot to unpack. Okay. As we have seen you and the passion and the energy that you have produced, and you've, as you answered some of these questions, we know about you from your past. As we go back to the Rogers Park, let me add more emphasis to Rogers Park and that sense of community and the parents that you have that instilled this sense of black knowledge and empowerment. And then you see that in your present stage right now with your production company and your community activism and, you know, how you raise your family. You know, let's talk about the future with Elevate Culture. What is it you want to, what do you want to pass out to the future as legacy for your kids?
Yeah, man. Just the power of family business.
Okay.
I would say one, the power of a family business. So I involve the kids in a lot of my meetings and just a lot of the business dealings that I have with my business. I keep them present. My daughter is about 11 now, but she really has been present for all of the sessions. She's done each one of them on the stage and a lot of the production meetings, listening and watching. And so it's really important that in the legacy I pass down to the children, less the trauma, less the financial illiteracy.
Hold on one sec, Quest. I want to. You're sounding kind of distant right now. I really need the audience to be able to hear what you got saying on this, because this is extremely important. Because I
can
barely hear
you
a little bit.
Better?
Much better, bro. Much better.
Okay. Yeah. So, it's important for me as a legacy piece to pass down the power of family business. Less the traumas and less the financial illiteracies and mental health issues that we may have personally. And also less the oppression that we've had to deal with, you know, less the pain that we had to deal with, but more of the freedom. of expression, the freedom that you could do anything you want to do. You could build whatever you want to build. You don't have to just grow up, go to school, and go find a job, work for 50 years and retire, and then spend the last 10, 20 years of your life beat up, sick, or with the least amount of energy because now you old and shriveled up. And so I want to teach the kids to know thyself and to love thyself and to trust and believe in your own abilities, you know.
That's right.
The legacy of edutainment, the power of entertainment, even though we look at entertainment like, oh, man, you know, I can be looked at as a negative thing, like, oh, man, you either have to sing or dance or shuck and jive or shoot a basketball or play a sport. That's the only way you're going to get out. And there's a lot of learning that takes place in just that side of the coin, in that creative, athletic, artistic space. So much to learn. Where would we be without music right now? Like, literally. Although I do believe that science is so important, ever so more now than ever before. Like, every day it gets more significant.
Okay.
That we don't miss the ball. So to promote science and technology and engineering, you know, art goes in there, and mathematics. We want to promote that and make that cool for the kids, you know, because everything that I do is about science, technology, engineering, art, and math. From music to holistic teachings and practitionerships to writing books to construction. All of my business endeavors theme is at the center of it. And it's so important that we reach back and start those kids off as early as possible.
Uh-huh.
Break generational codes of, you know, what's cool and what's not cool, what's normal and what's not normal. We all go to work, whether we know it or not,
right,
for somebody else.
True.
You might not have no kids, but you it's to also share with your friends and family. You know what I'm saying? Like, we work hard, you get some money, you call your friend, you call your best friend, you call a girlfriend, you call a boyfriend, or you got kids, or you call your cousins or your friends. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I go to work. I got two kids. So it's for my family first. You know, I want to make sure that we all right, that we don't have to want for much. We don't have to just exist in this world, and we can live a little bit. Like, be healthy, be safe, and experience great things. In one of my songs, I say, I want the money, but only because of what money can buy. The real work come within through the strength of your mind. And so I want to make sure that I instill that in my kids. I let them know every day. You know, I make sure that they're on their studies, but I also empower them with the emotional intelligence that they're going to need to navigate through this world, because a lot of us, we get in situations and we're not emotionally intelligent. And so without that type of navigation and GPS, you don't know how to get through those tough terrains. And
That's good.
It is
That's a good
so
word.
Important. You know, it's so important that you are emotionally intelligent in order to make it through to the destination. But we always remember that it is the character that is being built on the journey, on the quest, on the road, not the destination. Because there's not really a destination. You'll wake up every day and realize it's still right now.
That part.
Because that's all
I like
that matters.
That.
My great-grandmother used to tell me every day, she said, every time I would go visit her, she would say, when you coming back to see me, baby? And I say, I'll be over tomorrow, man. And she say, now, you know tomorrow is a day that'll never come, right? And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? And she kept saying it. And then as I got older and talked to her more and started to come into my maturation, it was symbolic of her telling me that all we have is right now. Tomorrow is a mystery. And by the time it is tomorrow, it will be the present. So take advantage of the gift of the present right now, because yesterday's history, right? And tomorrow's a mystery. It might, you don't know what's there. But when you are aware, when you are physically aware that tomorrow is now, it's your gift. Take advantage, because it's your present. And that was so, like, cold. That was like, just a parable, like so prophetic,
right,
to me, that I was like, man, never take anything for granted and always operate that right now is all we really have, you know?
I think we had some great great grandparents, man. They really gave us a lot of knowledge and a lot of energy, but we have to understand where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? We really have to understand where we came from. I remember saying this on a show a couple of episodes back. I said 100 years ago, in 1920, we were still under Jim Crow and segregation. Let's put that in proper perspective. 200 years ago, 1820, we were still in slavery. Let's look at all of the knowledge and the energy that we've gotten from parents, grandparents, if we're blessed enough, great grandparents, to be able to help us move forward. And I like the opportunities that you and I and Ray have shared, cultivating the complete part and the complete picture of Quest. I mean, because, you know, yeah, like I stated before, you have a lot of moving parts. And some people can get lost in those hats. But you seem to have harnessed it into one symbiotic relationship from one thing to the next thing to the next. And I want our listeners to be able to take away from that. I want our listeners to understand that they, too, can do some of the things that you are currently doing, that there is no limit to our potential. And that, I think, is huge. So Quest, thank you so much for being on this show, man. You truly amazing person, not just amazing talent, but an amazing person.
Mm-hmm. Man, I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak life, you know, into the people. I'm a people's person, a people's champ. You know, it took life coaching. It took really thinking about things holistically, and realizing how everything is connected. There was times where, as a construction worker, I didn't want my music world to know that I was grinding during the day, getting dirty with it, you know, building and trying to separate myself and partition myself, as the Western world likes to partition everything. And, you know, in the spirit of focusing in on a particular area, which is important sometimes, but we really have to realize that everything is connected.
Right.
And there's really no separation between church and state. It's all
true.
Connected. And so it's so important that we embrace all of the unique parts of us, and, you know, master something. Once you master something, you can move on to the next thing, because what will happen is you have muscle memory. And although you want to keep practicing and staying ahead of the curve, you just develop more bandwidth. You know, we're not using what they say, less than 10% of the brain.
you know.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
Our bandwidth, like Elon Musk is talking about, we're like dial-up computers to what we actually could be. So challenge yourself, and that's why it's important to be mind, body, and centered, I mean, and spiritually centered and aligned, because then you'll be able to, once you quiet down and able to, like, mind your thoughts and the chatter and everything, you ain't gonna be able to completely do it 100%, but it's a practice. You'll be able to have more bandwidth to be able to have more capacity to actually be more productive and do more. And so I just give thanks for that. I'm still a work in progress. And then you also have the discernment to know when to delegate and who to delegate to, you know. And
that
so
that part.
I look at all of those principles, man, and it all starts with spirituality for me. And so I'm just grateful to be able to share some of the story with you guys, man. It's going to be a book one day in my life where I really get to, like, break it down, you know, from a literary point of view. But right now, I'm going to just keep building out these businesses and creating legacy, you know, for the family and for other people to be able to grow and help me expand a legacy. Because it's not just my legacy. I'm just a part of something bigger. You know, I always tell myself in my prayers, thank you, God, for allowing me to be an instrument in your orchestra called life, you know, and allowing me to master my instrument so I can sound off my sound into the world. And if it can be received, man, that's a blessing, man.
That part. I love it.
Man. All right. Wow. That was a great show.
We covered a lot, bro. Yeah, man.
Thank you. And again, I just want to, like, reiterate what we were saying. Thank you for being on the show and for sharing your wealth of knowledge and, you know, just letting the people know who you are as a person. You're not just a DJ. You're a multifaceted individual and a multifaceted black man as well, with a family and all kind of other things.
And that's,
man,
huge.
I really thank you guys for the opportunity, brother. Thank you, man. Thank you.
So, audience, we want to thank you guys for listening again, and don't forget, COVID is out there. Y'all be safe, and you know, take some lessons from my man Quest here. Some of the stuff he's doing, he has his hands in a lot of pockets, so he can, like, keep himself going and keep himself busy.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about the cannabis piece, you know, and social
equity. Oh no, we're coming back to that. We will have a part
new
two
endeavor,
bro.
But yeah. Part two coming soon. Let's go.
Part two. Sticky to the icky.
All right.
All right.
Let's get it.
So our producer is trying to wrap up. So that's it. That's all we got for this time, and we'll tune in next time, guys.
Next time.
Respect, everyone. Have a blessed one. Thank you.
Peace.
Yep.